quite one-fourth, and never just half, but the entirety of one primate, whole. It is the part of a story, an idea that means more to you than me. Hello and welcome to Full Gorilla Life. We are Jeremy Keene,
Larry Medina,
and Corey Hewlings.
Each week, we will break down an important life concept or talk with an inspiring person so that you can live your full gorilla life.
I'm Christine Spencer. I grew up in Sebastian, Florida, went to Sebastian River High School, and I guess since then I went to college at Fordham University. I worked for the United Nations for about 8 years, and now I work for a nonprofit in Hawaii.
You know what? I feel like you just did a great job. I'm going to let that roll.
Okay.
There we go.
That's how I roll. Let's just go. So then, all right, Christine, so now that our audience knows who is actually that we are talking to, Jeremy's going to run you through the Gorilla Gauntlet.
We'll just 10 rapid fire.
All right, Jeremy, go.
All right, so Gorilla Gauntlet. We're going to go through 10 rapid fire. Here we go. Married or single?
Single, but dating.
Or dating. Sorry, I made that mistake before. So or dating. Yeah. So married, single, or date. Got you. All right. Any children?
No.
Okay. iPhone or Android?
iPhone.
Nice. Favorite movie or book or both?
Favorite book is called Blue Nights by Joan Didion. And favorite movie, I guess a fun one, would be The Big Lebowski.
Oh, that's good.
Love
there
it.
You go, the
classic,
dude.
Right? Great,
very classic.
What is Blue Nights? Is that fiction or?
Joan Didion, it's kind of about her life. And she was once a journalist, but she writes just really, this was more about losing her husband, I think. And she's just really interesting writer. She has a few books. Yeah.
Okay.
Favorite genre of music?
That's a hard one. I think it like depends. I like so much music, but I guess, you know, I like R&B and hip hop probably the most, I guess, over time.
They last longer. I got you. The ones you always go to.
New R&B at all or no? Anybody new that we should be listening to?
Like I listen to Izzo. I'm sure you've heard of her. She's more kind of like
Larry pop, loves Izzo.
Yeah, yeah. She's
that's my girl.
To her too.
Yeah.
Larry, like he lets my wife makes fun of me. And he sings it out.
Yes. Yeah, we've all heard Larry blurt out some Izzo.
Yeah,
listen. Good. Hey,
feeling good. Yeah. All
right. He's singing Izzo. We're in a good place in life.
Yeah. Yes.
That's the truth. We really are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of
this
that,
is true.
Beer, whiskey, or wine?
All of the above.
All of the above. So if you have one, though, you had to rank them.
You know what? I would probably say craft beer. I love, you know, all the new styles that have come out and just like there's so many new things to try. So right now,
it's fun, right? All the different flavors and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is that? He gets mad at us when we want to try new beers. So.
Yes. Yeah. He wants straight just. Beer,
he's like
nothing
yeah.
fruity, nothing, you know, has to be just beer. Yeah. It's like a beer purist, I guess. So being
a beer snobbist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes more
sense.
True.
Very snobby.
So in Hawaii, where is the best place to go get a craft beer?
Well, that's funny you ask. We have a place called Maui Brewing Company. We also have a little brewery called Kahola. So we have two small independent breweries.
What island are you on?
I'm on Maui.
Are you on Maui? My wife's from Oahu, so I was. Yeah.
Yeah,
we were supposed to go there in like a month, but
going now.
We're gonna wait a year.
We'll be waiting for you.
True Hawaiians were like, don't come.
Yeah, you know, you don't wanna. There's a place in Vero right now, Onuluau. It's a restaurant, and they carry the Maui.
Oh.
The Maui Brewing Company. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's sweet.
Check it out.
I worked for them after. I left the UN and kind of started this new chapter in my life. And it was just crazy. I was just kind of like a beer, selling beer and t-shirts and a tour guide. And it was probably one of the most fun jobs I've ever had in my life. But it was cool.
Okay.
That sounds fun.
So you graduated high school, right? You went to college. What did you study for in college?
I studied communications with a focus in journalism and Latin American studies. Communications is such a broad degree, you know, you can really do anything with it. But I kind of had an alternative college experience, I guess. You know, right after high school, I went into college. I lasted a semester and I dropped out. I just couldn't deal with the parking or something to get to the classes. Actually, you know, it was just a whole journey. My dad, he lost his business my senior year in high school. So the colleges I had wanted to go to, we couldn't really afford anymore. So it kind of put me on this path where I was like, okay, well, I tried it out. This wasn't where I wanted to go necessarily. So I'm just going to go work and see what happens. So I didn't actually go back to college until I was 24. And I got accepted to Fordham University. And then I actually worked and went to school at night for 5 years.
So you took a break then, right? So from graduating all the way through 24?
Yeah, from school, okay. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I mean, I did other things. I worked and, you know, I was really into art and I thought I would be like a playwright or an actor or something like that. So, you know, I explored different things. You know, that's what you do when you're young. And for me, it was kind of a process of elimination of what jobs I liked and what I didn't like. And so, you know, it was a different route, but it was definitely, I wouldn't change it.
I could appreciate that because like a lot of times people think I got to get back on that normal path that's there for everybody, college, career, boom. So like to explore that and really know what you want, I think I can appreciate
that. Yeah, it took me like 40 years to try and explore and try and do something different, you know?
I'm still exploring. I still haven't gone back to school.
Yeah.
That's fair too.
You know, that don't, you know, that are like you too, you know.
yeah. Okay. So, do you feel that taking that break helped you out with your career path?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think a couple of things, you know, that really helped me doing that was, you know, by the time this was around, you know, this was in the early 2000s. So by the time all of my friends had graduated college, the job market was really not good for new graduates. But since I had already had 4 years of work experience, professional experience, even though I didn't have that college degree, I felt like I was able to get jobs because I, you know, I had that experience already. So it definitely, you know, had an impact on my career path because I had that time to explore and do jobs I thought I would never do before just to get by, you know, just to pay bills. And I always tell people that, you know, try any job, even if you're a barista at Starbucks or something, you learn so much. I think it really did kind of impact the way my career went. Definitely just a non-traditional person in general. So I guess that's the way it went for me.
Now, do you think that when you went back to school, you said you worked through college then? Do you think that made you appreciate the classes you were taking more? Because my wife did about the same thing. She went back when she was 25, 26, somewhere in there. And she only went back part-time, worked full-time. But I feel like for her, it was a lot more, you know, each class counted, you know. Well, because we're paying cash for them, too, that, you know.
Yeah.
So as opposed to when she went to college right out of high school, you know, it was all on student loans. And, you know, she wasn't working. It was just going to school. And it was two completely different experiences for her.
Yes. No, I agree. For me, going back later, I felt like I really appreciate it more because, yeah, you are paying for it. So you see, you know, how expensive it is and how important it is to do well. But I felt at 24, there were some concepts that I could really grasp a lot more in the education than I may have when maybe it was presented to me when I was 18 or 19. So I feel like the knowledge that I was able to soak up at 24 was probably a little bit more than I would have been able to soak up at like 18 or 19. And you know, we're in different phases in our life then. And back then when you're younger, it's a little bit different. You know, you're not so much buckling down. That's kind of when you go wild, right?
Yeah.
School, right?
It makes total sense.
Right. So your education may kind of fall to the wayside of letting out those wild oats. So going back and just being in a place in my life where I was ready to learn and accept all that knowledge, I think really, yeah, it made a difference. I just loved my college experience so much.
So
I loved mine too much, I think. I went too early and then it took me longer. Yeah.
You went too early, took you longer, and then you went back.
Yeah. Later. Speaking of that, yeah, because when you go back to your master's, you kind of are doing it for more of a purpose. So therefore you like you're saying I took it more serious the next round.
Yeah. So out of college, then did you go into the United Nations right after that or?
I did. I was in New York going to college, and that's where the main United Nations Secretariat building is, or offices are. So when I was in college, I actually went through an internship. So I was, you know, like I said, I was like the oldest one in my classes. I was 24. Everybody else was 18. And I had this teacher who came in late, and all of her stuff was all over the place. And she's like, can one of you students please, you know, make copies for me? And everybody was so young and shy. And I was like a bartender at night. I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll do it, whatever. And just by kind of standing out to her, she got this internship opportunity that came from the UN. And she kind of gave it to me first because I guess, you know, I helped her out in a situation. So it was through that internship. And I interned for, I think, 6 months. And then I got a job. I was really lucky just to get a job right after that internship.
Wow, so cool. All because of Xerox copies?
All yeah. Because, yes. My poor teacher came in late. I mean, her papers were everywhere, you know, and she was really just like, can somebody make some copies? And all these younger kids, you know, they still have braces. And I was just like, I'll do it, you know.
You know what's funny is that when my wife was a teacher, that's the one thing that she'd be like, I got to go and make some copies. And I would always make fun of her. I'd be like, copies? Like, how hard is to make copies, you know?
Yeah, right.
So I was like, mess with her about that, but you know, so you saying that like makes me think of that scenario. Yeah, I know, Keen. Yeah, I got reprimanded, but yeah, it's all about the copies. So I could see that. So basically, they saw you as a go-getter. They're like, all right, well, this is somebody who may not disappoint me, so I'll take a chance.
Yeah, and I worked hard for that chance. You know, you work 9 to 5 for free, you know, for almost 6 months, and people can see what you're capable of. And so, yeah, I, you know, there's so many different divisions and offices, and the UN covers, you know, a lot of different work. So it was just a matter of finding kind of the right work, the right area that I wanted to work in. So I applied to this division called Africa Division 1, and they were working on the Sudan and the referendum for South Sudan at the time. And I thought it was really interesting work. So I was really, you know, that first job, I was, you know, really the director's personal assistant. And she was like a pretty brutal woman. People were pretty surprised, you know, that that I could handle her for so long. But, you know, that's just the way it was. And then I really wanted to get, you know, the field work. But the UN has a very complicated hiring system. And so, you know, you go in at a certain level and it's really hard to make that next level up. You kind of have to break out of the system at the level you're in. And it's hard to explain, but basically I started at like the lower level, G level, they call it. And to get to the higher level, the P level, I would basically have to kind of like come back in as a P level. You can't really jump levels. It's a very complicated
system
that they have. Anyways, so I started that work in New York. And at the time, the office was working with all the different, you know, heads of states or presidents or foreign ministers around the world to really get the Sudan, which was one of the largest countries in Africa at the time, to basically split into another nation. So there would be a new country, South Sudan, and that country would be run under more of a democracy. And so going through that whole process with that office and doing that at that New York level, it was really cool. And I, of course, wanted to go to South Sudan after, you know, working on that job for 2 years. So I went. Yeah, it took me a while to get recruited, but I got recruited. And like kind of the scope of my work, my title was communications officer. And so that really was kind of almost like being a little bit of a UN, a journalist for the UN, and then being able to work in a lot of different multimedia. So we had a radio station, we had a TV and film and video station. We had a spokesperson that, you know, was always giving interviews to a lot of different media. So that's kind of what I went out there to do.
So you were just in charge of kind of, you were in charge of like kind of hitting every network as far as communicating what's going on with you guys, like a like a PIO. Is that like another way that people call that position?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Public Information Office.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we, at the time, so that was a big part of what we did was, you know, informing all the different media around the world and also within our agency, all the different reporting, kind of came to us and we had to kind of analyze it or get it, available to the public, like our human rights report every year that came out. And so kind of even proofreading that and then making sure that the mass public can read something like that. So yeah, that's what kind of the bulk of it is, getting really important information disseminated for the UN.
How long were you over there?
You got,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Corey.
You said you got recruited by, who did you get recruited by to go there? You were still with the UN?
Yes. So the UN, they have what they call peacekeeping missions, and they have, you know, a lot around the world. And these peacekeeping missions kind of, you know, go into countries that are in conflict or crisis. And at this time, they were going into South Sudan more as kind of like establishing some government and peace building and really kind of working on this new democracy that they were putting in place. So it was basically through the peacekeeping mission. Where I got my job, and then I went out there.
Okay. So yeah. Was that the next step up for you then? Was that the P level, or was that still G level for you?
No, I wasn't. That's a good question. I actually went out there at the UN volunteer level. So I left my cushy job in New York, and I even went to Rome for the last bit of my time in that job. And then I totally took a pay cut, went out basically as a UN volunteer, worked my butt off. They still paid us, you know, a little bit. But then I worked for about a year, and then I got the P level finally. Yes.
Oh, so you actually took a step down before you could go up then?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that by design?
It's really, it was by my design, because there were only so many options to breaking through that barrier of moving up. And for me, that was, you know, going at the UNB level, getting that professional experience that they were really looking for. And then, yeah. So, you know, a lot of people have a hard time breaking that system, but that was kind of the best way that I could figure out how to do it.
Yeah. It worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
Yeah.
No matter how you slice it, whether it was right or wrong, it worked. And that's leads me to believe that it was the right way to do it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, I got lots of advice from colleagues and, you know, people who kind of, you know, had been down the same journey I had. So I felt like I had a lot of really good, you know, advice and support. And, what really happened was when the time that I went out to South Sudan, it broke out into a civil war, like 6 months after I got there. So my whole job almost, you know, changed, and it just became, like a lot more opportunities, because just like kind of what we're going through now with the global pandemic, you know, we lose a lot of staff, and essential staff are the ones that go back in, right? So I was part of the essential staff when the Civil War broke out. A lot of people couldn't come back in. And so I got to do a lot of jobs that maybe I wouldn't have gotten, you know, to do in a normal situation. So for professional growth and experience, it was incredible. The whole Civil War side of things and all those atrocities, that's, you know, obviously a whole nother side.
So what, when you say Civil War, right? Because like most people don't know what that would look like. I wouldn't know what that looks like. What does a Civil War look like in Sudan?
Well, it's, you know, it's a lot of, okay, I guess I should give a little backstory about All right. So, as I was mentioning, we went through this when I was working in New York, this referendum process. So the Sudan split from into two countries, and the South Sudan became the world's first nation. So what they did when they set up this democracy is there's a lot of tribes in that area, and there's a lot of tribal conflict. And so what they basically did was they decided to have a president who was from one of the main tribes, and then the appointed vice president was from another main tribe, and those tribes did not get along. So 6 months into that democracy, the president basically fired the vice president, and that's when the Civil War started. So it was very, very tribal. And on the ground, you know, that looks like a lot of, it's a lot of shooting. There's tanks, there's machine guns on the back of pickup trucks. There's, you know, flares at night. You see all the red lights, you hear it. I mean, it's just, you know, where I was in Juba, it calmed down a little bit. There are definitely other parts of the country that were just all the time. It's people running for their lives. I mean, what happened when I was there was, when this tribal, you know, civil war started, over 10,000 people who were in the, I guess, the more inferior, well, the two tribes were called the Dinka tribe and the Nuer tribe. And the Dinka tribe was the one that the president was from. And then everybody else, or the vice president, was the Nuer tribe. So we had this tribe, the Nuers, come running to the UN base for safety because they were just getting killed. You know, they could get killed just by somebody looking at them because they all have tribe markings. So they had different markings on their foreheads, which you could see if somebody was a Dinka, they had a big kind of V that was carved into their forehead when they were younger. And then the Nuer tribe, those tribe members had a different kind of marking on their face. So you could just look at someone's face and know what tribe they're in and just shoot them right there. And, you know, there's a lot of things I guess I couldn't share, but just awful human rights, atrocities.
Who appointed the president and vice president? Like, was it through like an election?
It was kind of through this whole referendum process thing where all the heads of states came together and, you know, I'm not sure who was the main decision maker in that, but I think that it was a big, you know, hopeful ideal, you know, to do that, you know, to hope that by getting two of the biggest tribes in power together, they could, you know, do something good for their country. And it completely backfired.
Wow. That's crazy. So you were there when all that was happening on the ground and.
Yeah, initially the fighting started and I initially was. It was on December 15th, and I think I flew out on the 14th because I was coming back to see my parents in Florida. But I did get pulled back in about 6 weeks after that. So really, when the fighting hit, I was lucky. I left the day before, but all my friends, they got evacuated. And then that initial fighting, they were able to cool down in Juba for the most part, but not, you know, it was all just very insecure. You just never knew when fighting would break out. But yeah, so I was lucky in the beginning, but I did get pulled back in and, you know, I survived. I don't know how, but you know, anything is possible.
So how long were you there for then?
For 3 years.
Okay. And were they still fighting when you left?
Yes. There's still a lot of conflict over there.
Yeah.
It's probably gotten worse. Yeah.
Yeah. So what made you get out then? Did you leave the UN completely at that point or?
You know, it was really an identity crisis for me because I'd been with the UN for almost a decade. And, you know, when you have a job for so long, it becomes so much a part of who you are. But it was a very dangerous situation. And I just kind of had that feeling like your luck could run out. And you know, right after I did leave, something really bad happened to a lot of my friends. And so it was just kind of an instinct I think I had. And, you know, my dad he's really a supportive man, but I remember it had been around 2.5 years and he's like, honey, you know, your 9 lives are going to run out. You got to get back home before they do. And I was like, yeah, you know, right. Maybe you're right, Dad. And really my health just really started to deteriorate so much. Because, you know, I had malaria, I had typhoid, there's no good nutrition to eat there. And so all of the stress and the kind of the stress takes a toll on your neurological, you know, system in some ways. So really, it was a mix of my body just telling me, like, you need to get out of here. And then, you know, what my dad said, and then just kind of thinking, yeah, it's time to get out. And I applied for another job that was in Finland, because I was thinking that would be really cool, the UN. I could have gone to Somalia, but that was really something I thought about doing, but it would have been even worse in a way than South Sudan. So,
and yeah, really, Somalia may be really bad.
Yeah, pretty bad. But, you know, when you get used to working in these war zones or these places, it's, I don't know, it's you have a different perspective. You know it's bad, but it's, you can get through it because, you know, I've done it before, I guess. So, but it was really taking a toll on my family. I think they're really worried for me. And yeah, absolutely. And so it was a mix of that, I think, you know.
What's it like on a day-to-day, though, when you're there? Like, you work, like, 9 to 5, then you get off, but the country's in a civil war, so, like, you go out, yeah, or you just...
There's, well, I started work, I guess, around, like, 8. I lived on a military base, and that's where our offices were, and we all lived and worked in containers. They're, like, 20 by 20, I think, wide, and then some of the offices were bigger containers put together. And so we could, you know, walk to the office and start around 8. You always kind of check the security, what's going on, you know, is it a safe day? Is there fighting nearby? And then just for work, it's just, you know, I guess you just do all of your tasks. And I would have to go travel a lot into the refugee camp, or the IDP camp, we called it. So as I mentioned, when the fighting first broke out, we got about 10,000 people like running for their lives, and they basically were in our backyard on our military base. And so, you know, a lot of journalists and a lot of, you know, media outlets were really, really interested in what was going on and what the UN was doing on that, you know, makeshift refugee camp that they have, you know, in their backyard. So it was fielding a ton of media and going into this camp and showing people around the camp. And, you know, I worked closely with some people from the U.S. Embassy there, you know, some fellow Americans in Juba, South Sudan. So they invited me for Thanksgiving at the U.S. Embassy and stuff like that. But they had a whole different criteria for safety for the U.N. I didn't carry a weapon. We weren't allowed to carry any kind of weapons, right? But U.S. Embassy people, they were packing all the time, right? And so I remember they called me and they're like, hey, you know, we need to take, you know, these diplomats who are visiting through the IDP camp. Can you take us? I'm like, yeah, sure. So I'll go meet them at the gate. I'm probably wearing like some ankle boots and some jeans or something, no weapons. And they're like, you just walk around this camp like that? And I'm like, I do, you know, I'm like 5 feet tall. I'm very unintimidating to people. And I was okay, you know, I was able to walk around that camp and talk to people in that community and, you know, just kind of, it was really hard though. It's really almost like these people are in so much pain and it's such a hard situation for them. And they're living on the ground with, you know, these plastic, that's not even really a tent. And then everybody wants to come and see it because they want to donate money, but we need to see what's going on. So it's almost just heartbreaking, you know, to take these officials to look at this, you know, but that was part of the job.
And to do that over and over. Yeah.
Yeah. Was there a language barrier?
I had a translator. I tried to learn Arabic. They spoke mostly Arabic, Juba Arabic. So Arabic has, you know, a lot of different dialects. But they did speak a lot of English as well, some of them. But we had, you know, a colleague of mine that was from South Sudan who spoke the language.
Okay. The other question I have is, so when you're with the UN, are you working for the UN or is that part of the US? Like, how does that work?
You're part of the UN as far as, you know, taxes and everything. I guess when I worked there, I was kind of considered an international civil servant. And so I was part of that kind of system. But, you know, when you travel, you get your own little light blue passport. It's called like a UN LP, laissez-passer. And then it's a little different when you travel, yes, as a UN, you know, staff member.
So, but are you an employee of the U.S. government or the UN, I guess?
The UN.
UN, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So
yeah,
you
they
said
paid out all of the, you know, all of my taxes and stuff for my government, which they do for all the employees. So you're technically considered, I guess, working for an international government or organization.
So you said at, when you went to leave there, you applied to a couple of different places. Where did you ultimately end up going from there?
Ultimately, you know, I had a hard time. I think just, I don't know if anybody could relate, but coming back, you know, from a war zone and kind of assimilating back into normal life again was a little bit of a struggle. You know, I really feel for all of our veterans out there and all of our young guys that do this and don't have the resources they have when they come home to just kind of settle back in. So I had a little bit of an assimilation period where I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. I thought I would probably just go back into the field because it almost seemed easier than, you know, adjusting to life as I knew it. So it took me some time. I was kind of on like a 1 year sabbatical. So I had an option, maybe if I wanted to go back, it was still on the table. But to tell you the truth, I had no idea what I was going to do. And my friend said, you know, I'm going to Maui for a vacation. Why don't you just come think about things? I'd never been to Hawaii before. And so I went, and then we stayed a week. Then it was time to leave. And I was like, I'm not going to get on that plane. I think I'm going to stay here. Everybody thought I was crazy. They were like, okay, something happened to you. Like, what are you doing? I was like, you know what? I just, you know, I was having that identity crisis. Like, who am I if I don't work for the UN? Who am I if I'm not, you know, in this setting, this global setting, you know? And I struggled with that.
You just went on vacation and decided and just said, I'm staying. Never left.
And never left. Yes.
That's awesome.
It's true.
Huh. So know, that was your trip to Maui? Like, you were just like, yes, I'm just going to stay?
Yes.
So, mm-hmm. So you only bought a one-way ticket? Not knowing?
No, I did have a two-way ticket, but I went back and a couple weeks later. So I just delayed my ticket, went back, got a car, and then came back. And yeah.
Did you have friends to stay with, or?
The friend that I went with had family here, and so her cousin lived here. So yeah, I was I think 34, and I was staying with two 21-year-olds. You know, it was kind of hilarious. I was in this loft that they had in their house, and it could have been more of a comic relief. I tell you, those girls just kind of, you know, really brought me back to, you know, what life is in this country sometimes. But I didn't really know too many people here, and I just started over, and you know, I wasn't sure what was going to happen, but I had to work. You know, I still have student loans to pay. So, you know, I just kind of said, I'll take any, you know, Maui's kind of a different place. It's very transient as well. And so job opportunities are a little bit slim sometimes. But as far as, you know, working for an international organization, you know, how is that going to translate on this small island, right? So it took me a few years before I got the job that I have now. And now I work for the Alzheimer's Association, which is, you know, a national nonprofit that's working with family and people living with Alzheimer's and dementia. So
you've actually been in Maui for 2 years?
For five. Going on five years. Yeah. So
what was it about Maui? Was it just the weather, the atmosphere?
Hooli hooli chicken?
So many things. You know, it's just, I think, you know, there's so many beautiful places in the world. There's so many, you know, paradises out there. But for me, this is kind of like a paradise, and it was in our country, and I really wanted to be a little bit closer to home. But there's really something about the nature here. They call it there's a strong mana or a spirit here. Just feel something so strong about, whether it's the ocean or the mountains or there's a volcano, or there's just something really healing, I think, about this place. And that's kind of why I stuck around.
I've never been to Maui. I've been to Oahu 3 times, and every time I start looking for places to move back, but Liam, my wife, moved back and just, I'll stay. And then we look. It's, you're right. Like, the people there, the culture, it's just it's definitely a different feel. And I'm sure Maui is very similar to Oahu. So, but yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing that, you know, this is in our country. It's just, yeah, it's a really cool place.
So Florida versus Hawaii, right? I mean, you've lived in both. What is the major difference besides the mountains, right? What is the one thing that would make you want to stay in Hawaii versus Florida?
That's a really tough question. Y'all, I love my home state, Florida. Okay. I just have to say it's
less, you know, humidity.
It's great.
less humidity. The trade winds keeps it down.
Maybe I think it might be, you know, not to get all political, but people in Hawaii seem, it's a little bit more of a bluer state. People are a little bit more open-minded, not saying that everybody in Florida isn't, but just overall, I think, you know, there's just a little bit of a different mindset, and it's more of a melting pot here in some ways, a mix of cultures, really, a little bit.
Okay.
But, you know, it's really hard to compare the two. I love them both, so.
So, all right. Favorite Hawaiian dish or food? What do you go with?
That's a tough one.
Is Huli Huli chicken all it's cracked up to be?
It is. Yeah. That is okay. a really good one. Yeah.
I really want to try it. So I'm curious. I've had a lot of the different Hawaiian dishes, and some things I like and some things I do not like.
Have you gotten acclimated to spam?
A little bit.
Yeah,
it's like wrapped in seaweed and rice.
I make it here. Yes.
Yeah. Jeremy made it for me.
No, my version's not good.
Not good. It's not Jeremy, good.
For yeah. Look.
Any 7-Eleven.
When I go to Hawaii, I'll try it.
Yeah, mine wasn't great.
I'm gonna try it because I'll always do whatever is in that wherever I travel. Like I'll be like, yeah, I'm gonna give it a shot.
Do you like lala?
I do. I'm a big poke eater.
I can't do it.
What is that?
But the lala though, it's lala's like wrapped in like the leaf. It's just very strong green. Yeah. This flavor.
What is that?
It can be different things in it, but basically
pork or fish.
Yeah, and they wrap it, and they wrap it in the leaves. I forget which one. I think it's just, but the leaves are so strong that it takes over. To me, it just takes.
So
over.
So is it boiled? Else. What is it?
Yeah, you can steam it. I think you wrap it.
Steam it. People cook it, you know, a lot of different ways. But the poke is just ahi tuna, like sushi grade tuna.
But it's better there. It's definitely better there.
It's really good. So I eat a lot of that.
Okay.
I
think of poke personally, and I probably have a really terrible way of looking at it, but it's like the lazy man sushi, because you just kind of throw it together in a bowl, right? Am I wrong thinking this?
Yeah, I think you're wrong, but it's all right.
I don't think you're wrong.
No.
You don't need sushi, Corey.
Yeah.
He doesn't get to have a vote.
There you go. I don't need to roll this up.
That's a funny way to look at it.
Yeah. Look, if I was making sushi, I would go the poke style. So.
Yeah. Because is it still sushi rice or is it not sushi rice?
It should be. Do you get it over rice? Yeah.
But is it the same rice that they use like in sushi or is it a different style of rice?
I think sushi rice is a little different, but the poke bowls you can get with whiter
rice. It's a stickier rice.
Oh, maybe I would like it then because I don't like sushi rice. That's what I don't like about it.
Oh, okay.
I don't like the fish either.
Places in Florida?
Yeah, I was going to say, like,
there's a couple.
Yeah. All right, so Christine, you also mentioned that you went to Rome.
Yeah.
What was that like? Like, so were you stationed in Rome for a while or?
I was not for very long, but so towards the end of my New York days, that director I was working for, she got they call it a tour of duty. And she was going over to Italy, to Rome, to work with the former prime minister of Italy. And they were setting up this kind of emergency response mission to this region of Africa called the Sahel. So she took me over with her and I helped them kind of set up this office in Rome. And then we had a couple of offices in different parts of Africa. We had an office in Timbuktu, you guys. I mean, who can say that, right?
Yeah.
So it was, you know, living in Rome was, so wonderful. It was so cool. I mean, there's just so much beautiful architecture and people and food, and it was really an amazing job. They had, you know, like sparkling water that you can have from the water fountain. So you can get like still or sparkling, which I thought was so cool.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm all over that.
Yeah.
Right.
That's life changing for Larry.
Yeah. It is. I'll do that. Yeah, I would. Corey is mad because I was bringing a 12 pack of seltzer to his house, and you know, I was like, "Would you stop bringing seltzer over?"
He brings a 12 pack of seltzer and then drinks one of them, and then it's for later. There's so many different types of seltzer in my fridge, like you can't organize it correctly. Okay, and then my OCD kicks in. And I can't, like, have enough rows because he's got 17 different types of self.
Yeah. I do that on purpose, by the way. But, all right, so in Rome, what pizza, way different, way better, way, like, is it different than New York style? Like, what do you think?
It's different. Yeah, my favorite one that I was getting was very thin crust kind of pizza. You know, here it is a little different. It's definitely really good over there for sure. Even the sauce is different, but I ate a lot of pizza over there. I think I gained 8 pounds when I lived in Rome.
How long were you in Rome?
I was there for I think 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Nice. Maybe just under 2 months.
Not too long. Pound a week isn't bad when you're, you know, eating.
That's a good point, Keen.
That's nothing. That's nothing.
Yeah, that's
historically, nothing. what was your favorite place that you visited in Rome?
You know, I Rome, oh geez, you know, there's a lot to see.
Yeah.
My office was right by the Colosseum, which was cool. We kind of got that, you know, view, you know, from our office.
That's cool.
You know, I kind of went all over the city. I didn't really know anyone there. You know, I was with maybe 4 people from New York, the team, and they were all, I think, in their 50s. They were quite a little bit older than me. So I had, you know, to get out on my own and explore. And I literally just would take a bus and go all these different places and end up somewhere for dinner. And when you're a single woman in Rome, the waiters like bring you champagne and they're like, hello, like you really get treated well, I have to say. So, you know, I loved Rome, but when I got out, one of my favorite places was Florence, which, you know, you could take a train to Florence. And that was just a really gorgeous place as well inside of Italy. But yeah, it was a great time there.
Christine, Rome. you should have reached out. I would have went and visited.
Yeah. Christine, no doubt. You should have reached out to Larry, and I would have tagged along with
you. Yeah, because I would have been like, I mean, I got to figure this out, right? We got to figure out how to get to Rome. I would have figured it out.
Yeah.
Credit card debt is probably the route, but
yes. It would have been
fine. Yeah.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, there's always bankruptcy, guys, okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's the advice.
Yeah. It'll be worth it.
Yeah,
it would be worth it.
Jeremy is saying no. He's not going to
Jeremy's
say
like, no.
No, I would go. I would just want to just
would you go
it.
For credit card debt, though?
Yeah.
I would plan it out. I'm a planner. I plan it out.
That's a no, Jeremy.
You have six weeks.
I can plan it out in 6 weeks.
No, you wouldn't.
Sort of. I would go. Sounds like a great place to go.
So I do have another question, and hopefully it's not too insensitive, but PTSD. Did you have any of that coming back?
You know, I think that's a really taboo thing for people that were working in my industry to talk about, you know.
Okay.
But yes, I did definitely have some of that. And I definitely had to talk and get help from someone. And I, you know, did a lot of different things to kind of get through that. But it was really initially hard. I wouldn't say I felt it as soon as I got home. I think it was maybe like 6 months into being home when I kind of like, you know, just having really not being able to sleep, having these really vivid, you know, flashbacks. And I was driving in my car. I was going to the gym. And I guess I was thinking of, you know, something, a flashback of something. And I literally was lost. I was like, where am I? Where was I going? And I was like, okay, something's wrong here, you know, but it's just a really hard thing to put your finger on, you know, if you aren't really, you know, I don't know. There wasn't really any support when we left. It wasn't like, hey, you've just been through this crazy experience. Now you have to get a little bit of help from somebody, you know, in our team. It's kind of like, all right, you're back in the world, you know, kind of probably what they do with a lot of our veterans too.
And, yeah.
You know, the thing about PTSD, and I tell people this all the time, is you don't have to go to a war zone to have PTSD. People get in car accidents, they lose a loved one, they experience something traumatic in their normal life. And I think, you know, that's probably, you know, it was just, yeah, it's just kind of a taboo thing for the industry I was in to talk about. I still don't openly talk about it with a lot of my colleagues that I worked with. It's just not something that we really would talk about. But yes, okay. On a really honest level, yes,
I appreciate that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And now, go ahead.
Yeah. So now you're in Hawaii and you're working with the Alzheimer's Association. What's that been like?
It's been really almost like a dream job in a lot of ways because I get to do a lot of different things for them. I basically am the regional manager for Maui County. So we have three islands here. And I'm really kind of working to implement the education programs and all the support services for the community. So it's been really challenging because Alzheimer's disease, I don't know if any of you guys have it or dementia in your family, but it is devastating what it does to families. And so it's here also in Hawaii and the culture, you know, getting out there, it's a little different in certain ways, you know. Not everybody is ready to go to the doctor because they think they have a memory problem, you know. So there's a lot of stigma around the disease here still. And so trying to kind of break through that stigma and help people get connected, you know, to get the right resources has definitely been a challenge, but the community here is amazing. I mean, that's one of the best resources everybody has here is the people. And so it's just been really rewarding to work with, you know, everybody that is trying to support these families and the people that are going through this terrible disease. So it's been a really a great job. I'm so fortunate.
Yeah. My grandma had Alzheimer's and it was not good. Like, it was just awful to see her go through what she went through and the hardship really for the family as well, right? Like, just trying to make sense of it when you don't know. At the end, it got so bad where she didn't know how to eat.
Yes. Yeah.
No. Wow.
Yeah.
My
grandmother had it as well, my dad's mother. And yeah, it's devastating. I was young, but it's still devastating to see, you know, like, them not recognize their own family and their grandkids and their kids and all that kind of stuff.
What's funny about my grandma is that she didn't recognize anybody. But when my grandpa would show up every time, if any nurse tried to talk to him, she would like want to fight them. Like, she knew this is my guy. You know,
yeah.
she didn't really know anybody. But for whatever reason, when he showed up, she would be like, hey, you know, don't even look at him because this is my guy.
Did she still recognize him then? Or was it more of just internal? Is it more instinctual? Did she recognize him, like, that's my husband? Or is that more just instinctual, like she had that connection like that?
I don't know, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are moments where, that is really funny. She's my kind of woman. I like her. there are moments too, where sometimes, you know, the memory could be a little lucid and it might come back for a moment. You just don't know. It's just a really, it affects everybody differently.
You've been working for them for 3 years now?
Going on 2 years.
Oh, going on 2 years.
Yeah. Before this, go ahead.
Has there been any, developments in treatment or anything, or like, as far as like how they're treating them?
You know, there's a lot of promising research out there. And I think right now, you know, there isn't really anything to prevent it or a cure. And what we know for the treatments they have now, we know that they can kind of like alleviate some symptoms and maybe slow down a little bit of that process, but nothing that can really stop it. So as much as there's so much promising research, you know, there isn't anything that's really going to stop it right now. Does that answer your question? They've tried to work on a vaccine, but that's still many, many years away. And like I said, it affects the brain so differently. Everybody Every individual has almost a different case. That it's really hard to find what works for everybody, you know, to find the universal, you know, medication that's going to work for everyone. It's just such a complicated disease.
Yeah, because I had where my wife actually had a neighbor when she was in high school, and she'd always come over to the house thinking that it was like World War II again, and she'd have a knife in her hand, and, you know, people were going to come to get her and all that kind of stuff. And that was kind of the same way. My grandmother wasn't, you know, not the same scenario, but she was always afraid somebody was coming to get her. I remember they found her walking along the railroad tracks with knives in her hand, you know.
Yeah.
Multiple times. It got to the point, and that was going back probably, what did that, would have been like late 80s. So there wasn't a lot of help out there, you know, in the late 80s. I remember going to the house and my parents taking all the knives out of her house because that was like, that was literally like a solution to the immediate problem. It wasn't like, what are we going to do? It was like, we got to get these knives out of her hands, you know, like, but, you know, there wasn't nearly the help that there is now, I guess, you know, because I've seen in our own community, you know, now they have tracking bracelets, and I don't know if you guys have that out there, but, you know, and the sheriff's department has a program with their dogs that, you know, certain dog handlers, you know, search for these missing Alzheimer's patients, and there's a lot more support out there, I guess. And in Port St. Lucie, they have a huge Alzheimer's Association, like, daycare, you know, where they can go, like, for the day, you know, if, you know, you work or your parents work that are taking care of them, stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, the disease is growing even more and more. So, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of support, but that's also because there's a lot more people getting this disease, you know, and it's almost it's 5 million people now, and that's going to keep growing until we really have a way to prevent, you know, people from getting it. But
what do you think of things like that Neuralink? I don't know if you've heard of that. This, like, the Elon Musk thing where essentially it's like a chip that's going to go into your brain. And essentially the thought process is that they're looking to treat Alzheimer's with that, as well as other people with other kind of brain injuries. But yeah, I mean, have you heard anything about that or?
I haven't. I'll have to read and see what it is, but I'd be interested to read about it. You know, the thing, I don't know how it would work. What happens when somebody gets the disease, what, like, in the brain, there's these plaques, or they call them tau. So it's almost like a plaque buildup on the walls between the neurons that need to communicate. And so that plaque will build up to where the neurons can't communicate anymore. And then the tissue, brain tissue, will start to shrink and die. So if that chip can, I don't know, prevent the plaque from coming or be able to, you know, decrease the amount of plaque, I mean, that would be cool. So I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's something along the lines of, like, it sends like electrical pulses when it detects something in the brain that's going on, and supposedly kind of like give you like a jolt that would get you back. I don't know. It's just what I heard him talk about. I don't know.
I've heard of it, but I haven't heard
it. He read this on some website somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Some conspiracy site, you know. Since it's 5G.
It's like straight from InfoWars or something. Like, they had an advertisement.
Yeah, that's legit, right, guys?
Yeah, sounds like to me.
Oh, man.
That's awesome.
So, all your experiences, have you ever thought about writing a book?
I think you should.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's, I went through this thing where it was a really cathartic experience where I did write all of, you know, kind of the different things that went on when I was in Juba. But I don't think that's something that I would ever publish, and I love to write. So yes, you know, I think that's definitely something I think about, and I would love to do, but I don't necessarily think anybody's clamoring away to get, you know, my life story, or I don't know how comfortable I am with the whole, you know, memoir thing. So, so if I do write something, it's probably going to be a little bit more fictional, but based off of some of the experience I've had.
I think that'd be fun. That would be awesome.
Yeah. That'd be therapeutic too, even fiction, because you get to kind of like put all that
knowledge into place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you, Christine. Like when I saw you on Facebook like a while back, and I saw you like a couple posts of like where you were, I was like, the hell? Like, you know, like I would have never thought that, you know, but it's something that not a lot of people do. And so I definitely commend you. I think this is fantastic, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because like life experiences, you know, you can't buy that, you know. And so to me, like your life experiences are just, you're phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's nice to hear too. Like I want to have my kids are young, but I'd like them here just to watch. Like, you know, we have people here in Sebastian. We get stuck in Sebastian. And it's nice to hear the stories that, you know, you can venture out in the world and see your oyster, right? So like, it's kind of cool. I agree.
All right, Christine, before we let you go, though, we do like to ask our final question. Based on your life experiences, what is one piece of advice you can impart on our listeners?
Yeah, I think kind of just, you know, segueing into what Larry said, you know, a lot of people didn't expect me, you know, to go out into the middle of a war zone and work this job. And, you know, and I tell people all the time, like, don't do what people expect you to do. You know, you are the one who writes your own story. You don't have to listen to people telling you who you should be or who they think you are or anything. And I always just think, you know, just go for anything you possibly can, even if it's not what people expect you to do. It's your life. So do it. And I think, you know, part of that is finding your own identity and, you know, finding out who you really are. And a lot of times that doesn't have a lot to do with what people think you should be or, and finding that true happiness, you have to really do things that you may not even expect of yourself. You know, I always kind of say, I didn't appreciate home or know what home was in Sebastian, Florida until I left, right? Until I went so far away. So I think a mix of my advice would be, you know, just break through your own barriers that people give you because you really can do anything you want to do and be anybody you want to be. And that's up to you. That's not up to other people.
Absolutely.
Can't say it better. Yeah.
All right, guys. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at fullwheelerlife@gmail.com.
And if you want to see what's going on our social, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at fullwheelerlife and on Twitter at gorillafull.
And last but not least, please visit our website, fullgorilla.life, and please hit subscribe on your podcast app of choice. Adios.
Later.
See you.